This podcast was recorded at the 2017 JADPRO Live at AppShow Conference in Houston, Texas. The title of this session is Advances in the Management of Patients with Urothelial Carcinomas of the Bladder, and it is presented by Emily Lemke and Amishi Shah, the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. To view the presentation material, see other topics of interest, and learn how to earn credit for these activities, please visit advancedpractitioner.com/sessions2017. And now we're delighted to bring you this podcast from JADPRO Live.
Welcome back from lunch, everyone. My name is Christopher Campin, clinical pharmacist at the Greenville Health System in Greenville, South Carolina. Our first lecture is on the advances in the management of patients with urothelial carcinomas of the bladder. It is my pleasure to welcome our speakers, Dr. Emily Lemke and Dr. Amishi Shah, both of the University of Texas MD Anderson.
Well, thank you so much for having us today. We're very excited to be here. Amishi and I spend probably the majority of our waking hours during the week with each other, and about half of that time is talking about bladder cancer. So we're really excited to share this talk with you. So these are the learning objectives, which I'm sure you have. All right, so bladder cancer is the sixth most common malignancy in the United States. And I think that it's a little bit underrepresented in a lot of forums. So we're obviously happy to have the opportunity to share the advances with you. Most common signs and symptoms are going to be hematuria. I would say kind of the standard picture that we see in our clinic is patients who have painless hematuria, maybe some other lower urinary tract symptoms, and they're treated for a UTI kind of a couple times, and when that doesn't help resolve these symptoms, they get a better staging workup and ultimately are found to have a bladder mass. Most common risk factor is going to be smoking. This is the biggest one, and of course with other malignancies, advancing age. And then there is a component with urothelial carcinomas that chemical exposures do put you at higher risk. So this is just kind of a nice pictorial view of the different stages of bladder cancer. So as you probably know, a big differentiating factor is whether or not the cancer is invasive into the muscle. And I think this just kind of provides a nice example of, you know, the different layers of the bladder. And this is a picture that Amishi and I draw for all of our new patients who come in with bladder cancer, because I think it really helps clarify the hows and the whys of the treatment we give. And so T2, this is going to be the muscle invasive disease. And so anything T2 and above is going to be what her and I see in clinic. Pretty much T1, TA is going to be managed by urology. And so the focus of this talk is really going to be on T2 and beyond. Okay, so a staging workup, you're found to have a hematuria that's not resolving, so you start with a CT, usually of your abdomen and pelvis, maybe chest if you're pretty suspicious from the get-go. That'll show a bladder tumor or just some thickening of the bladder wall. This then usually leads to a cystoscopy. And these are what urologists do. We're not doing cystos in clinic. And so once a bladder mass is identified on cystoscopy, the next piece is going to be resect that with a transurethral resection of the bladder to URBT. This is where we're going to get tissue. Something that we do at Anderson that isn't done across other institutions is at this point our urologists do what's called an exam under anesthesia. Abbreviation is EUA that we'll use throughout the rest of the presentation. And what they do during the TUR is they actually feel the back of the bladder wall through the rectum with their hand. And so in these cases, if they can feel a 3D mass, we consider that clinical T3 disease. And that'll become important when we're determining whether or not they meet the qualifications for neoadjuvant therapy. So if any neurological symptoms are present at baseline, we'll also do a brain MRI. And then anybody with small cell histology, we're going to get a brain MRI as well. And then a bone scan if we're suspicious of bone symptoms. So as I said, TA and T1 disease is something that's primarily managed by urologists. And so this kind of just is a summary of that therapy. Usually at first it's a TURBT followed by intravesical therapy. And whether or not it's low risk, intermediate risk, or high risk is going to dictate what that type of intravesical therapy is. And then also some people might need an upfront cystectomy if they have more advanced T1 disease or if they recur following intravesical therapy.
So I'll take over to discuss muscle invasive disease. So as Emily mentioned, the initial staging workup is so critical because it really helps define which path a patient goes down. So T2 disease is what gets into the muscle of the bladder. T3 disease is what approaches that perivesical fat layer, so the thin layer of fat that surrounds the bladder. And finally, T4 disease is anything that goes beyond the bladder towards adjacent organs. So board answer, standard of care, for anybody with T2 or greater disease, they need neoadjuvant chemotherapy followed by surgical consolidation. And we'll go into some of the nuances in a moment here, but the gold standard for neoadjuvant chemotherapy for these patients is either the regimen of dose-dense MVAC or gemcitabine cisplatin. So the initial work that was done in neoadjuvant chemotherapy, there was a couple pivotal papers. Many of you may be familiar with the regimen of MVAC, methotrexate, vinblastine, adriamycin, and cisplatin. The initial work was actually done with just the CMV part, not the adriamycin part. And in that work, there was a suggestion that patients who had chemotherapy up front actually had higher rates of path CRs at the time of surgery. And there was some suggestion that that translated directly to an overall survival benefit. Following that work, this was really the seminal work that led to the approval of neoadjuvant chemotherapy for T2 and more advanced localized urothelial cancer. So this study had two arms. Patients received either neoadjuvant MVAC or they went straight to cystectomy. So in the patients that had chemotherapy followed by cystectomy, they had a better overall survival. And that survival improved from 46 months to 77 months and leading to the gold standard of neoadjuvant chemotherapy. Of note, with this particular MVAC regimen, almost 40%, 38% of patients had a path CR, meaning no viable tumor left at the time of surgery. So I wanted to take a moment here to deviate to talk about times that we actually potentially spare patients that chemotherapy. There are particular risk factors that we think are riskier features. And so in patients that have suggestion of variant histology, which essentially means doesn't look urothelial or papillary under the microscope, if they have variant histology of micropapillary, sarcomatoid, plasmacytoid, these are things that make us think, okay, this is a more aggressively behaving tumor. Chemotherapy is going to be more helpful here. If they have hydronephrosis, if they have lymphovascular invasion, or they have that palpable mass in the exam under anesthesia, those are all things that say, okay, this is perhaps a more aggressive behaving tumor, and neoadjuvant chemotherapy truly is key. In a patient who doesn't have these risk factors, there's about 70% of them that can be cured with surgery alone. And so in those patients, if they have none of these risk factors, we will often let them proceed to an upfront cystectomy. If there's any surprises on path, certainly we want to offer adjuvant chemo. But if you see these risk factors, really hammers in the fact that they should be offered chemotherapy up front. So let's talk a little bit about the standard of care regimens. Both of these regimens are cisplatin-based, and that is the drug with the most data in urothelial cancer. So the original trial done with neoadjuvant chemo was actually done with an older regimen that was not dose-dense scheduling. It was just plain MVAC. And that was a very difficult to tolerate regimen. Patients had severe mucositis. It was really tough to get them through. However, with the advent of this dose-dense scheduling, it has become a much more easily tolerated regimen. And so we use this actually really on a daily basis in our clinic. So dose-dense MVAC is scheduled every 2 weeks. Typically, patients get chemotherapy on day one of that two-week cycle. If they have a slight, you know, reduction in their GFR, we may split that cisplatin on day one and day two in that two-week cycle. But what we have found is that the advantage of dose-dense MVAC is it's 8 weeks total of chemotherapy leading up to surgery rather than 12 weeks, which is what the gemcitabine cisplatin plan has, since that's a three-week cycle. So it's a shorter time to surgery, and the rates of path CR are much higher with dose-dense MVAC. Gemcitabine cisplatin is the other gold standard. There was a study done comparing gemcitabine cisplatin to the traditional MVAC. It was a non-inferiority study, and so gemcitabine cisplatin was found to be non-inferior to MVAC, meaning equal in terms of that survival curve in that study. But like I mentioned, it is a three-week dosing schedule, so it is a slightly longer time up to that surgical consolidation. And in all of the reports with GemCis, the path CR rate is about 26 to 28% tops, so a little bit lower than with dose-dense MVAC. However, of course, with the MVAC, because you have that Adriamycin component, you have to make sure your patient doesn't have any major cardiac comorbidities, has a healthy ejection fraction. And so we do tailor that regimen based on people's underlying comorbidities.
In our practice, we really don't feel limited to just using GemCis or MVAC if patients don't meet qualification for those. Cisplatin ineligible is technically defined by a creatinine clearance of less than 60, and we really we can push that a little bit with some different regimens and with some supportive care. And so in the case that we're not able to use either dose-dense MVAC or GemCis, this is kind of the menu we turn to. So for somebody who's truly cisplatin ineligible, somebody whose creatinine clearance is less than 40, somebody who has significant neuropathy or hearing problems, the regimen we'd use is this gemcitabine, paclitaxel, doxorubicin, or GTA as we call it. And this is a regimen that's dosed every 2 weeks. We give it outpatient. And for the most part, patients tolerate it exceptionally well. And we've had some really good luck with this regimen. So we don't jump to no chemo or immunotherapy in that situation. For anybody with small cell histology, which is, of course, a much more aggressive variant of bladder cancer, we treat with the standard of care would be etoposide cisplatin for four cycles. But there's been some papers put out by our clinical faculty looking at this doublet of ifosfamide, doxorubicin, and etoposide cisplatin. And so typically they start out and get IA one cycle, then the next cycle they get EP for a total of 4 to 6 cycles. And this has been pretty efficacious for these small cell patients. It is a tough regimen though, and so these patients need to be fit. They need to have a good ejection fraction to get that IA. And the IA is something that we do give in the inpatient setting. For people who are kind of at that borderline creatinine in that 40 to 60 range, or maybe have a little bit of tinnitus or a little bit of neuropathy, that we still want to try and get them cisplatin, we will do this regimen called CGI, and it's cisplatin gemcitabine ifosfamide. This is dosed every 2 weeks, and the cisplatin dose is 50 milligrams per meter squared, as opposed to MVAC and GemCis, which have this 70 milligrams per meter squared dosing. And kind of similar to the GTA, patients do pretty well with this. And we kind of do it both inpatient and outpatient. If somebody's got a creatinine closer to the 40 or 50 range, we might do it inpatient and just give them a lot more post-cisplatin hydration for 15 hours following therapy, as opposed to in the outpatient setting where you're obviously limited by the time of the infusion. And so we play with this, and we can also give it over 2 days, which, as Amishi mentioned, we do with MVAC and GemCis as well, splitting that cisplatin dose. But if a patient can get cisplatin at all, we really try to do that in the neoadjuvant curative setting. And then this last one, ifosfamide, doxorubicin, gemcitabine, IA-GEM, this is kind of the big guns. If we have a really fit patient They're young. Typically, the unofficial rule of kind of around 50 or younger, and really few comorbidities. We will hit them with IHM. And a lot of times we save this for people who have variant histology or who have not responded maybe to MVEC or GemCis at first. So when they get IHM, we usually do 3 cycles. And if they haven't seen cisplatin, we'll follow that by 3 cycles of MVEC. This is dosed every 3 weeks, and it is also an inpatient administration, primarily because of the ifosfamide dose, the risk of neurotoxicity. They need to be frequently monitored by the nursing staff and inpatient staff to make sure they're not having any hallucinations or other neurotoxicity symptoms we can sometimes see with those higher doses of IFOS. So monitoring with cisplatin chemotherapy, obviously, the creatinine clearance is going to be something that we're constantly looking at, and we always calculate the Cockcroft-Gault creatinine clearance. We are not using the EGFRs that are pushed out in the CMP. Electrolytes with cisplatin, we can see a lot of hypomagnesium, hypokalemia, and so I would say for the majority of our patients, we're having to do some supplementation of magnesium almost in everybody. Obviously, you're going to be asking about hearing, neuropathy, anybody on cisplatin-based chemotherapy, and if anybody's getting the anthracycline. We're monitoring echoes at the beginning of therapy and then typically about every 3 to 4 cycles. And, of course, with any chemotherapy, cytopenias are going to be something we keep an eye on. So in the ideal situation, we like to see our patients in between cycles for a toxicity check. And we use this as an opportunity to kind of boost them up so that we can keep them on schedule. And so if their creatinine is taking a hit in between, we might give them some more IV fluids. We might give them some, electrolyte repletion. Nausea, vomiting is something with these cisplatin regimens that can be problematic. All of our patients who get cisplatin actually will get 3 days of dexamethasone, 4 milligrams BID for 3 days following chemotherapy. And we find that does a pretty good job of nipping the nausea and vomiting in the butt. We usually send them home with Zofran and Breglin prescriptions as well. But when the nausea and vomiting is refractory to that, we've had some really good success with olanzapine, the 10 milligram dose. And then, of course, we need to give blood occasionally. And anybody getting neoadjuvant therapy, we're going to be doing Neulasta as well. All right, so moving on to a case study. So this is a gentleman we both saw at clinic. He was 49 years old, never smoker. His presenting symptom was gross hematuria. His upfront imaging revealed a left lateral urinary bladder wall thickening, no hydronephrosis, no suspicious lymph nodes. So he went on to have a TURBT, and that revealed muscle-invasive bladder cancer with focal micropapillary features. Also suspicious for LVI, and his EUA was negative. No comorbidities. He had an excellent creatinine clearance, so kind of world was our oyster as far as what kind of chemo we could give him. EF was 62%. So do you think that he should get neoadjuvant therapy? And what regimen do you think he should get? I'll give you the answer in the next slide. So definitely needs chemotherapy. Why? Because he's got muscle-invasive disease, he's got micropapillary, which is an aggressive variant histology, and the suspicious LVI. And what chemo did we give him? Dose-dense MVEC. He had a high chance of a path CR with that regimen and a quicker time to surgery. So this was his CT before he started therapy. And you can just see some kind of bladder wall thickening right there. And then it improves a decent amount after he's gotten the 4 cycles of MVAC. And so this is the gold we're looking for every time, is this guy had a pathologic CR. So this is a real success of a patient with a very aggressive cancer who we're able to give the highest chance of cure in a setting with, you know, micropapillary bladder cancer. All right, so another case study. This guy was 73. He, again, had painless hematuria, and this is his TUR path. He had papillary urothelial carcinoma, high-grade, non-invasive, and the muscle propria was present. Now, this is a point that Amishi likes to make with all the fellows that come through our clinic, that the board answer is, if you don't see muscle propria present on the TUR specimen, the answer is you need to repeat a TUR to obtain muscle specimen, because we absolutely need to know if the bladder cancer is in the muscle or not. All right, so this was, he had a nice clear tumor in the bladder right there. All right, so does this patient need neoadjuvant therapy? Give you the answer right there, no. Why? Because it was not muscle invasive and he didn't have any high risk features. So this guy went back to urology and he has had a TURBT followed by some intravesical therapy.
So let's switch gears here for a moment and talk a little bit about upper tract urothelial carcinoma. The upper tract actually refers to the ureters bilaterally as well as the renal pelvis. And the ureters and renal pelvis are both lined by urothelial cells. So biologically, the upper tract behaves very similar to bladder cancer. Even though it's much higher up and has traditionally been sort of its own entity, biologically it really follows some of the same patterns as run-of-the-mill bladder cancer, with a couple important things to note. So upper tract makes up only 5% of urothelial carcinomas. It is more rare. The times that we have seen it, automatically Lynch syndrome should be on your radar. So many of you are familiar, very familiar with Lynch syndrome. The most common hereditary cancer that forms in patients with Lynch syndrome is colorectal cancer. That's followed by endometrial cancer. But it is becoming much more clearly recognized entity that upper tract urothelial cancers also fall within that spectrum. So any patient that comes to our clinic, whether it's localized or metastatic upper tract urothelial cancer, we do send microsatellite instability testing to screen that patient for Lynch syndrome. Unfortunately, because the entity of upper tract urothelial cancer is more rare, there's not great guidelines on when to do neoadjuvant and adjuvant therapy. And so we see a lot of patients that are referred to us from elsewhere that actually undergo upfront surgery. And we actually, if we are seeing the patient ourselves at the beginning, we actually really take much more of a stance like we do for bladder cancer, where if there is any high-risk feature that we're concerned about, we highly recommend neoadjuvant chemotherapy for them before they go on to a consolidative surgery, which for upper tract disease, the consolidative surgery, rather than a cystectomy, is a nephroureterectomy. And so extrapolating from bladder cancer, the risk features we look for is if it's high grade under the microscope at the time of path review, or if there's evidence of sessile polyps on direct visualization by the urologist, those are reasons that we will give those patients neoadjuvant chemotherapy. We use the same regimens that we use in bladder cancer. So again, cisplatin-based chemotherapy is the gold standard, but the other regimens Emily mentioned, if their GFR is compromised, are also fair game here. The other thing that's really interesting with urothelial cancer in the upper tract, especially if it's got evidence of microsatellite instability, just like in other tumor types that are MSI high, there's a really nice role for immune checkpoint inhibitors here. So we have a couple patients in our clinic with Lynch syndrome, and for example, one of our patients has a GFR of 40. Well, we put him directly on pembrolizumab first line instead of committing him to chemotherapy, and he's had a beautiful response. The success rate of immunotherapies in the microsatellite instability high setting is quite high, approaching 90% in some retrospective reviews. So keep that in mind if you see a patient with upper tract, that should be something that should be worked. So going on a little bit longer about the benefits of neoadjuvant chemotherapy in upper tract, it's much easier for patients to receive chemotherapy prior to their nephro-U. Their GFR is going to be better. And then the same concepts as apply as with the bladder cancer. We want to eradicate any microscopic disease that might have escaped that area. It does often help the surgeons with that downsizing, and the time of surgery is a lot easier for them to consolidate. we know there is a reduced risk of recurrence, and patients are much more fit before surgery. After surgery, they're healing up from a huge wound, their GFR has declined, they're more deconditioned. It's hard to get them through four cycles of chemotherapy on the back end. So when in doubt, we go ahead and give it neoadjuvantly. Going to the metastatic setting, again, the same regimens are really key in the first-line setting. So in the first-line setting, we do rely upon that cisplatin-based chemotherapy. In the second-line setting, this is where many approvals for the immunotherapy realm have come into play. However, please do take note that if a patient is cisplatin ineligible, immunotherapy is approved and indicated in the first-line setting. As Emily mentioned, technically the definition of cisplatin ineligible is a creatinine clearance less than 60, severe underlying neuropathy, issues with hearing loss. However, we do push that envelope, and if a patient has creatinine clearance of 50, we don't necessarily deem them cisplatin ineligible off the bat. We might use an alternate regimen. So immunotherapy in urothelial cancer has been kind of an interesting story. Five drugs that all behave pretty similarly were approved back to back to back in bladder cancer over the course of the last year plus. And so these drugs include atezolizumab, nivolumab, avelumab, durvalumab, and pembrolizumab. So of those, there's two, nivolumab and pembrolizumab are PD-1 inhibitors, the other are PD-L1 inhibitors. And the big question we often get is, how do you decide which one to use? What are the pros and cons? And so I'm going to talk a little bit about the data behind each of them, but keep in mind that they do have very similar mechanisms of action. So atezolizumab was the first immunotherapy agent approved in urothelial cancer. The approval of atezolizumab was based on the results of this phase 2 trial that was published in Lancet Oncology last year. And this was a trial where all patients, it was a single arm trial, and all patients got atezolizumab after they had progressed on previous platinum-based therapy. So this was in the second line setting. And this, the patients that received atezolizumab, all of them, had an overall response rate of upwards of 20%. That was a very clear improvement of the 10 to 15% that we had typically seen with second line traditional cytotoxic chemotherapy. So based on that objective response rate, the overall response rate, the FDA led to the approval of atezolizumab. There's a couple interesting things to note from this data. In urothelial cancer, immunotherapies are approved agnostic of PD-L1 status. We do not really check or really determine if PD-L1 expression is high, they should get it. If it's low, they shouldn't. That is not an entity in urothelial cancer. It is approved across the board, regardless of PD-L1 status. And that being said, the PD-L1 story has really played out in different ways. It's been a little bit messy of a story in urothelial cancer. So you can see in this atezolizumab data, the patients who had high PD-L1 expression, which is represented by the blue line on the Kaplan-Meier curve, did seem to have a better response, but all comers actually had a better response compared to traditional therapies, so it's still approved across the board. A quick update here, and this data is still sort of pending. We don't have the full paper, so we don't know the exact details, but atezolizumab actually was evaluated in a phase 3 study. So it was taken head-to-head compared with cytotoxic chemo in the second-line setting. Physicians were allowed to choose their choice of cytotoxic chemotherapy in the taxane family versus atezolizumab. It was a randomized study. And all we have right now is a press release saying that this study did not meet its overall survival endpoint. So based on that, we don't know whether it was, the patients that were chosen, we don't know if there was crossover, we don't know if truly what this means, if it really didn't improve survival, but just know that in the phase 3 setting, atezo did not improve overall survival. And that'll come into play again in a moment. Nivolumab was the next agent approved in urothelial cancer. Again, this was a phase 2 setting, and again, approval was based on the fact that the objective response rate was improved compared to normal cytotoxic chemotherapies in the second line setting. And again, you see this sort of representation that perhaps the patients with higher PD-L1 expression did better, but all comers still had a better response rate compared to chemotherapies. Pembrolizumab I want to spend a little bit longer on because this is the category 1 evidence of NCCN. This is what we use daily in urothelial cancer in our clinic. So the first approval for pembrolizumab came in the second line therapy, just like for atezo and nivo that we discussed, again, based on objective response rate. However, that was followed by this study, which was a phase 3 study comparing head-to-head pembrolizumab versus dealer's choice chemotherapy in the metastatic second-line setting for urothelial. And here, pembrolizumab did achieve an overall survival improvement. So there was a definite higher response rate as well as improved overall survival, leading to the approval of pembrolizumab in this setting. And it's, if you see on NCCN, while all of these are listed, this is the highest, strongest data, and so the one that's utilized more frequently. So again, it is after that, on the tails of this paper came that its approval in the platinum ineligible setting. Pembrolizumab is dosed every 3 weeks. Depending on which agent you use, some of them are dosed every 2 weeks, some are dosed every 3 weeks, so that's something to keep in mind when you're thinking about patient convenience and such.
So there's still a lot we don't know about immunotherapy. You know, these drugs have still only been around for the last 3 or 4 years, and specifically in the bladder cohort, there's a lot that we don't know. As Amishi touched on, the usefulness of whether or not their tumors express PD-L1 seems to be an inconsistent story across all of the approvals and their respective studies. The whether or not PD-1 is superior to PD-L1 blockade, something we also don't know. Combination with CTLA-4 blockade, which is ipilimumab, is the one we all think about, is something that's kind of coming out as being investigated right now. We don't know if that's going to provide a more robust response than the PD-1 alone. And then, you know, combining with cytotoxic chemotherapy. In the lung data, I know they are looking at pembrolizumab, carboplatin, and pemetrexed. And that's something that is being explored currently in the bladder data as well. So kind of stay tuned to see if combination therapy is going to be the next treatment. And then sequencing of treatment. You know, with these upfront approvals in cisplatin and eligible patients, is there benefit to having pembro or immunotherapy prior to chemotherapy or vice versa? Amishi and I are kind of in the thought of we still, if we can give chemotherapy to patients, we still like to do that prior to turning to immunotherapy. A lot of times these patients have a lot of symptoms associated with metastatic urothelial carcinoma, and the response rate is just going to be quicker if you can get them on a cytotoxic regimen. Duration of treatment. You know, how long do you keep these people on these therapies? If you have one of those outliers who's has a very long durable response, a lot of times they do not want to stop being on their immunotherapy. And we just don't know if that response is going to remain durable if we take them off. And then, of course, moving this up to the curative intent and even the bladder sparing setting where immunotherapy can be useful. And a big thing that everybody's wondering is how do we predict who's going to respond to these immunotherapies? Of course, we have the data now in the MSI-positive population, but what are the characteristics? We don't have clear set, this patient is great for immunotherapy, this patient isn't. So, you know, we're kind of trying it on everybody if they progress after chemotherapy. So I know we had an excellent talk on immunotherapy side effects yesterday, so I will not belabor this point. We're very privileged in our department that we work with some of the leading voices in immunotherapy, and so we have kind of a standard set of labs that we check in these patients. And so before we get them started on any immunotherapies, these are the baseline labs we check. They're all listed there for you. And then in the case of toxicities, this just kind of outlines with the kind of more common toxicities we see, the endocrinopathies, diarrhea, pneumonitis, what we're checking, and you know, having those baseline studies is important because some of these markers can be a little bit nonspecific. So knowing, checking them initially is going to help you kind of tease out whether or not side effects that are happening are indeed related to the immunotherapy. So early detection, I would say, is the most important thing when you suspect an immune-related side effect with these patients. I tell everybody at the beginning of therapy, you know, for the most part, people tolerate these therapies excellent, but there are, you know, about 10% of patients who are going to have some significant side effects. And, you know, we don't know what we don't know. So anything is really possible with these. So I, of course, educate them on the more common side effects, the colitis, the pneumonitis, the things we can objectively talk about, known presenting symptoms. However, what's important is that these patients know throughout the duration of their therapy, if anything seems off, that they need to tell us, because nothing you know, is out of consideration when you're on these therapies. Anybody who you're suspicious for colitis for, we do like to get a biopsy to show the lymphocytic infiltrate in those patients, and we'll, you know, obviously we all know about the 1 mg/kg steroids as management, but in the cases that patients are steroid refractory with colitis, we also use this mesalamine or infliximab. All right, so this is an example of a patient who is currently on immunotherapy. So this guy is a 54-year-old. He had metastatic urothelial cancer to his regional lymph nodes, and so he was heavily pretreated. He got kind of everything we've got. He got IHM times 4 cycles, didn't touch the lymph node. Got dose-dense MVAC, didn't touch it. Same with GTA. So then about, oh, and here's the lymph node. So after he started nivolumab, and this was on trial, because this was about 2.5 years ago that he was started on Nivo, you can see that the node has disappeared. And so this guy would be so thrilled for us to tell you that he's doing excellent. He continues on nivolumab. He will not let us talk, or talk about even stopping it, because, you know, that's one of the things we discuss is, should we take him to cystectomy? Should we stop the nivolumab? Should we spread it out? So these are things that, in his case, he's very opposed to. So he continues on nivolumab. He is thriving at life. He's winning amateur car races. He's in pool competitions out in Vegas, and he would love to know that I shared that with you, because he's so proud of that, and he's so excited to be kind of one of our poster children for nivolumab.
So as Emily mentioned previously, there's a lot we just don't know about where things are going to head. You know, there was nothing in the field of bladder cancer for 30 years. All we had was chemotherapy until all of a sudden in the last year we got 5 immunotherapies. And so it's kind of an exciting time, because things are going to change and hopefully keep getting better and better. But it's really kind of a big question mark which way things will go. So we hope to see in the coming years some expansions on the approvals for immunotherapy. There's a couple specific arenas where there's a lot of work ongoing. So one of those is sort of combinations of immunotherapy. So for example, both CTLA-4 and PD-1 or PD-L1 blockade are under investigation. We know there's higher response rates with those combinations. However, there's also increased toxicity. So how do we balance that? How do we manage that? And does it really improve our overall cure fraction down the line? Other areas that are being investigated with immunotherapy are potential combinations of chemotherapy and immunotherapy. That has panned out in other tumor types, such as lung cancer, and, you know, with bladder cancer having a higher mutational burden, exposure to tobacco and other sort of irritants. This is an area of great interest. Can it be moved to the neoadjuvant setting? And in these curative intent patients, it likely will in the coming years, but there's a lot unknown as of date. Further molecular characterization is key, and I'm going to go into that in just a second. It really helps us to tease out the individual biologies that patients are following in urothelial cancer. So many of you are familiar in breast cancer with the different subtypes. You have HER2 disease, you have ER/PR positive disease, you have triple negative disease, and they behave incredibly differently. You go down different treatment algorithms for each based on this very core feature. Well, in the recent years, there has been very similar work done in urothelial cancer, and we think this is really going to help guide a lot of future treatments because we're finding the same story, that these diseases behave very differently based on their subtype. So there's a number of groups that have done this, and so some of the terminology is a little bit different, but to sort of summarize, these are the major three subtypes that have come out of urothelial molecular characterization. So basal subtype is the most aggressive biology. We see a lot of high proliferative markers on these tumor specimens on pathology. Traditionally, they have the poorest outcomes, and these are the patients that often walk into your clinic metastatic at presentation rather than a recurrence later on down the line. Interestingly, these are the tumors that are chemosensitive, and so these are the patients you don't want to miss that opportunity to cytoreduce them with chemotherapy. This, in my mind, is sort of similar to the triple negative story of breast cancer. So again, you want to remember chemotherapy in this type of biology. Luminal tumors often start out very superficial, we have found in bladder cancer, and they have a high predominance of FGFR mutations. And so there's a lot of work being done with FGFR inhibitors in bladder cancer, both in the metastatic setting as well as the localized setting, to see how we can target these alterations. There's also work being done with FGFR and immunotherapy combinations. We see the luminal histology sometimes more often in the micropapillary. They're certainly not, you know, hand in hand all the time, but it's sort of an interesting predominance there. And then the P53-like patients are sort of the ones I think about as the ER/PR positive breast cancers, the lower proliferation. They have a lot of stromal enrichment. They tend to be pretty chemo resistant, but they do have better outcomes because it just seems to be a more indolent type of biology. We see more bony metastases in these patients. And so, I think this is going to be a real key principle in bladder cancer in the years to come, because as these branch out and we find out more and more of these individual subtypes, it's really going to help us to better guide therapy towards each patient. Right now, we kind of hit everybody with one umbrella or the other, but it's going to branch out a lot more in the years to come. So just a sort of a quick plug, you know, we all are used to doing this across different tumor types, but some of the things you may want to consider in your metastatic urothelial patients, panel molecular testing is always a good thing to send to see if there's any kind of targetable mutations that we can do for that patient. FGFR, I just mentioned, because there's a lot of national ongoing interest and trials in this arena. MTAP is another area that's becoming increasingly interesting. Patients that are MTAP deficient, it's just an IHC marker that's checked, seem to be a little bit more sensitive to chemotherapies in the pemetrexed and methotrexate family. Interestingly, when those patients are treated with pemetrexed or methotrexate, they actually have upregulation of PD-L1, so you can maybe potentially nicely follow that with an immune checkpoint inhibitor. So consider testing that, again, in the setting of if you have access to a clinical trial that's looking at that. And then the microsatellite instability, you want to think about definitely with your upper tracts, but there was some nice work at ASCO earlier this year that we're maybe under-recognizing it in bladder cancer too, and so certainly consider sending that in the metastatic setting to see if there's any role for immunotherapies for that patient. And with that, we're happy to take any questions. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you. That was really informative. This is probably kind of a novice question, but for the folks that are candidates for a radical cystoprostatectomy, who decides whether they get a neobladder or a urostomy? Like, how does that work? And then also for the people who have a ureterectomy, so what do you do to get the urine down to the bladder?
So for the first question, the kind of neobladder versus ileal conduit, that's something that our urology colleagues really make the decision on along with the patient. I would say the majority of our surgeons at Anderson are doing about 80% ileal conduit, about 20% neobladders. And there's different qualifying characteristics that the patients need to have, specifically with their GFR. And so in order to get the neobladder, you have to have, I believe, a GFR greater than 60. And, you know, I think it's pros and cons, age of patient, what kind of lifespan do they have left, you know, the self-catheterization that can need to happen with a neobladder might sound like a piece of cake at age 50, but, you know, ideally we're curing these people and hopefully they're going to be alive at 85, 90. And, you know, if you've got urinary retention in that setting, it's a little bit of a different game. So, and then the surgical time on the table, I know, varies between those and neobladder. I think can be approaching 10 to 12 hours, and I think a cystect or the ileal conduit is, I think, 6 to 7 hours. But this is all information our urology colleagues have shared with us, so don't quote me on any of that. And your second question was about urinary diversion in a nephro-U.
Yes, so if they have a ureterectomy, then where's the urine go?
Well, since they still have their other kidney and ureter, it diverts through that. Since that kidney is removed, they're not having their urine come through there. So.
One of the other things that goes into sort of the decision about ileal conduit or neobladder, our patients will actually go to a specialized clinic where they do all kinds of fittings. So they see where does that patient's pants sit, do they wear a belt often, you know, what's their body habitus like, and they're really kind of thoughtful about where to discuss placement as long as it's surgically feasible of that conduit so that patients can be a little bit more comfortable. So it's a big preoperative part of the plan.
Hi there. I had a question about, you said sometimes you're able to spare folks neoadjuvant chemotherapy for high-grade muscle-invasive bladder cancer. We give a lot of neoadjuvant therapy. So is that an institutional policy where you're basing the risk factors, or do you have data, or
So great question. It is, I think, right now very much of an institutional practice for us. We've gotten quite a bit of data together with our urology colleagues over the years. So at our institution, for example, if a patient has T2 disease, so just in the muscle, not T3 or beyond, doesn't have any of the high-risk features, our long-term outcome is that 85% of those patients are cured with surgery alone. So based on our, you know, internal validation of this data, we feel like a lot of those patients were, you know, can be spared chemotherapy of 85, up to 85% are cured with surgery. And so that's where this risk stratification kind of came about. There is other data about it sort of that's been published, but I think by and large the majority of people do practice that any degree of muscle invasive T2 disease does require neoadjuvant chemotherapy. And we feel the same, that if in doubt, err on the side of caution and go ahead and give neoadjuvant. But if really a patient just has no high-risk features, a minimal amount of disease, something to consider with the idea of adjuvant on the back end if you need.
It's usually a pretty easy sell to the patient if you're telling them that they don't need chemo. So we don't get a lot of pushback on it as well.
And one other question. You mentioned in your MS, you had a patient that had the microsatellite instability and... See, what did I write down? So you gave them upfront pembro. Was that in the adjuvant setting or metastatic setting?
He was metastatic, actually. He was metastatic, okay. And had been diagnosed with Lynch syndrome, seen a genetics counselor and everything. And part of it was that he just wasn't a good chemo candidate. He had had a lot of issues with previous surgery where his GFR was impaired. And so we did pembrolizumab, and he was, you know, he's 45, so he was so nervous of, I feel great on immunotherapy. Are you sure it's doing anything? Am I even getting treatment? And so it's a nice option for those patients with Lynch, but especially because in the microsatellite instability population, they just don't have great responses to chemo. But definitely in the metastatic setting, not indicated in the curative intent setting.
Thank you. What's the increased risk for the Lynch patient population? I know it varies between which gene mutation they have, but is it 20%, 5% increase over the average population? Do you know?
Bertrand?
Yeah, it's in the 15 to 20% range. And we check the same, you know, same as colorectal. The IHC includes the MLH1, MSH2, MSH6, PMS2. And then we verify that with the PCR assessment.
You said you use creatinine clearance, Kakaval versus EGFR. Mm-hmm. Is that because EGFR over or underestimates kidney function?
Yeah, so the GFR that your BMP or your CMP spits out is going to be just based on the average average weight, average height, average of patients. And so if you, with the Kolkoff-Gall, it's a more personalized measurement of their kidney function because the calculation includes their weight, their creatinine clearance, their age, and their gender. And so it's just a cleaner measurement. That being said, if you have somebody who is very morbidly obese, you know, you might look at both and kind of meet somewhere in the middle, but for the most part, it's a better measurement, more specific to that patient. Thank you, everybody.
This concludes this podcast from the 2017 JabPro Live at App Show Conference. To view the presentation material, see other topics of interest, and learn how to earn credit for these activities, please visit advancedpractitioner.com/sessions2017.